Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. For decades, gay and bisexual men have not been able to donate blood, a 40-year-old policy enacted by the Food and Drug Administration that has been criticized as discriminatory. But in the decades since, the FDA has slowly relaxed restrictions for men who have sex with men, but some still argue its exclusions are unfair. For example, the FDA allowed gay and bisexual men to donate blood if they refrained from having sex for a three-month period. But now, the FDA has made a change that is considered to be a significant milestone for donating blood since the policies were first enacted in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. In its update, the FDA lifted the abstinence portion for men who have sex with men, as long as they're in a monogamous relationship, which isn't a requirement for other sexual orientations. And a lot of research and study went into this change by the FDA. One of the partners in this research is Vitalant. They are the leading blood donation agency in Northern California. Dr. Chris Gressens is the medical and laboratory director and joins us with more about the FDA's policy change. Good morning, Dr. Gressens.
Good morning, Ms. Gonzalez. Vicky, please call me Chris, and it's a pleasure being here.
Well, Chris, this has been, you know, months in the making, and Vitalant was part of this research. Before we get into the news from the Food and Drug Administration, let's start off with some context. Give us some perspective on the need for blood every single day in the United States and here in Sacramento.
Thanks so much for asking. The need continues to be great for a number of reasons, most especially patients more than ever are needing blood for both regular day-to-day needs, trauma, burns, other types of accidents and problems, the kinds of diseases that we've been treating throughout my career, and then finally, pent-up demand. Over the last couple of years, more and more patients who postponed their treatments during the COVID pandemic are catching up, and that's a good thing, but the challenge is it means more of a strain on our resources, including blood. Lastly, fewer people in general are coming up and bearing their arms for blood donations, so we're delighted by the news that we're going to be discussing shortly.
Well, a moment ago, I briefly talked about the old FDA policy and the new policy that was just announced last week. But let's dig into that a little bit more. Walk us through the history of this policy. Why was it first put into place and how it evolved to a point where the FDA decided it was time to make another significant change?
Well, I appreciate this chance to share very briefly the history. Going back actually to the late 70s, early 80s, when, as you and many of your audience, but perhaps not everyone know, HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, came into prominence. This was a scary time. At the time, I was an undergraduate and young medical student. And I recall a lot of good people were trying to figure out how we can prevent the spread of this disease, as well as treat appropriately patients who have it. And one of the prevention methods at the time that was most important was safeguarding the blood supply. To put this into perspective, of the 20,000 people living with hemophilia at that time who received infusions from blood donations, half of them, 10,000, came down with HIV, and an even greater percentage with hepatitis C virus. So this was not a trivial issue, as you can imagine. Lives were being infected in great numbers. So around that time, screening came into play, and unfortunately, as a result of our not having enough tools at our disposal, the screening was done with a very broad brush. And as you noted earlier, as a result, by the mid-80s, even though we had a test in place that was pretty good, we also, as an industry, decided to exclude people who were most at risk for HIV, which, of course, at that time, and to some extent still remains, men who have sex with men. Over the years, we've evolved this. I think it took longer than was probably needed. But then again, good people wanted to make sure the evidence was in place before making changes. The never again philosophy, never again will we allow a disease burden like this to enter the transfusion supply, weighed very heavily. But we have evolved. And I'll just finish up by saying that by the mid 2010s, as you may be aware, we had moved towards a 12-month deferral for men who had sex with other men, which still wasn't ideal by any means because it still denied too many good people from the LGBTQ community the chance to donate, to participate in this. By 2020, we had reduced it to 3 months from last sexual MSM, male sex with another male contact. Now, finally, we're to a point based upon the evidence where we're asking the same question of everybody, whether male, female, or transgender. We're getting to individual risk-based assessments. Let me stop there and hand back to you. Those were more than a few sound bites.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. So as I understand from you, because essentially each person is given an individual donor assessment, you have to answer a series of questions to assess your risk whether to donate blood. So what I'm hearing from you is everyone is getting the same individual donor assessment regardless of... Okay, so that's across the board. So
absolutely.
What about the distinction about in its update last week that lifting the abstinence portion, you know, a 3-month deferral for men who have sex with men, as long as they're in a monogamous relationship, does that apply to everyone as well?
Yes, in a way. And if I might briefly describe the question and answer-based approach by which we use this. So again, for me, for you, for a transgender community member, the same question will be asked, have you had in the last 3 months more than one sexual partner or a new sexual partner? If the answer is no, for instance, for people in committed monogamous relationships, that's it. Answer is no, move on. If the answer is yes, then there is a follow-up question, and again, it applies to everyone. Was the practice of anal sex involved in that sexual relationship? And if the answer is yes, at this point, a 3-month deferral will apply. Still not perfect as far as inclusivity, but it's being used across the board for whomever the individual is, including heterosexual couples who have had anal sex. So we're reaching a point of greater inclusivity and equity and hoping over time to take this even further.
In regards to the donor assessment, Vitalant issued a statement, and it says in part, while individual donor assessment is an important step, we understand that for some, it may not go far enough. Can you clarify that latter part? It may not go far enough for some people?
Yeah, thanks for asking. And that is because I can share with you from our CEO's perspective to mine's and all of my, just about every coworker I can imagine, we are absolutely geared towards diversity, equity, inclusion. These are not just words. I've lived them with my colleagues. I may be a 58-year-old white dude, but I can tell you at the same time, we are committed to doing the right thing for people of all backgrounds. So with that preamble said, we recognize that the sexual experience is a universal one, that most people in their lives are fortunate enough to have sex, and that certain sexual practices are more specific to people of certain backgrounds. Whereas a heterosexual individual has more options for sexual contact, including, and I'll just use, you know, clear words, I don't think I'll offend anybody by saying penetration abilities, whether vaginal or anal for a heterosexual individual or oral. We recognize too that for two men, anal and oral are the primary sexual options. So with that in mind, we appreciate how for somebody who is not in a monogamous relationship or has a new partner, how this can still be constricting to those individuals. We appreciate that. And I won't necessarily say we apologize for that, although we feel bad about it. But at the same time, we have a duty to protect the safety of the people who get the blood that we collect. So maybe I'll sum up by saying that we hope to do even better over time, including as we develop means for destroying viruses in all of our blood products. And we're not too many years away from that. And my anticipation is when we reach that point, or when we artificially can create blood, which is probably beyond my career timeline, then we'll be able to dismiss these restrictions altogether. Does that start to answer your question, Vicki?
Yeah, thank you. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Chris Gressens, Vitalant's Medical and Laboratory Director, about the FDA's policy change to allow more gay and bisexual men to donate blood. So Vitalant helped in this research to clear the way for this new policy. How did the research work? How long was it, and what was entailed?
Yeah, well, we, with our advanced study that was spearheaded by colleagues in our San Francisco-based research lab, worked with a very large group of gay men, over 1,500 individuals, with whom we discussed questions related to HIV risk, and also for whom we did HIV and other blood testing. And we ultimately showed where the risk was and where it was not for HIV, including vis-a-vis blood safety. And we saw that the risk was not with monogamous individuals who were in long-term committed relationships. And we also saw that for somebody whose last sexual contact in a non-monogamous situation involving anal sex was more than 3 months ago, we saw that while there was risk there for HIV in these individuals, our tests are capable of detecting that infection so we can prevent blood coming from those people from getting into a patient. So those details were tremendously helpful. Finally, though, I'll share, we also have learned from our brethren and brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. As I think you may be aware, Canada did this just over a year ago. United Kingdom, even longer. Other parts of the world, even longer. And we've seen from their experiences that there are greater numbers of donors who come in and that the risk is not significantly increased.
I want to get to the technology portion, the screening that happens for blood donations, just very briefly.
Yes.
On NPR's All Things Considered, host Sasha Pfeiffer asked pathologist Dr. Benjamin Mazur with Johns Hopkins University if he thought the rule change will prompt many people who used to be excluded from donating blood from now wanting to donate, as you touched upon. Here's what he said.
There will be more people donating blood from the gay and bisexual community. I'm happy about that. However, now, you know, they specifically want to know how many partners you're having, how recently, what types of sex you're having. Straight or gay, not everyone's comfortable giving this information to strangers, to a medical organization. And so that's also going to discourage people from donating.
And I bring that up because the FDA sent a statement to NPR saying that they maintain the current high level of safety of blood. The approach to this work has always been and will continue to be based on the best available science. But in that same interview, Dr. Mazur touted the robust blood screening programs for all blood donations, saying that there hasn't been a transfusion-associated infection since 2008. It was a single infected donation 15 years ago, and that's out of like tens of millions of blood transfusions done each year. So what about the argument to trust the technology and science as opposed to a questionnaire that, you know, that some would argue targets specific communities?
Yeah, great question. So with regard to the last HIV transmission being identified from what's 15 years ago, that's absolutely true, although that's part and parcel to very rare phenomenon that nowadays you can't really estimate risk based upon how many cases you see, but rather based upon some theoretical constructs. And those theoretical constructs put the risk currently for HIV in transfusion at somewhere around 1 in 1.5 to 2 million, plus or minus. So undoubtedly, there are other rare cases of transmission occurring that we're just not seeing. People don't, after their transfusions, bother getting tested. In some cases, people will die unrelated to the transfusion. So you could make the argument, though, that those risks are still tremendously low, But they are not just because of the testing. The testing, as good as it is augmented by preventing people at higher risk prior ever to giving blood from doing so. So the two work in tandem at this point. The tests, as you know, I realize, won't pick up people very, very early in their infection. On average, right around a week to 12 days after infection when they still can transmit HIV.
And that technology you touched upon earlier is updating.
It is updating. And really, while we probably won't close the test window much further, much as we'd love to, the belts and suspenders approach of our using inactivation techniques for destroying viruses, as well as other pathogens, such as parasites like malaria, bacteria, such as E. coli and Staphylococcus. These are all things we can do for certain types of blood products, but not all yet. We're getting very close, though. The research suggests that I hope within my career span, and I'm looking at maybe five-ish more years thereabouts, we will be at that point. And I hope then that we can revisit this issue in a more thorough manner, because I'd love everybody at the table.
Finally, yeah, a change like this doesn't necessarily happen overnight. Logistically, what needs to happen for Vitalin and other blood donation centers to comply with these new guidelines?
I'm so glad you asked. So we have anticipated from January, when FDA first put this out as a draft guidance, that this was going to happen fairly quickly. FDA, Dr. Peter Marks, in charge of this, was so committed. So we actually have put a lot of our new systems in place, not yet operational, but in testing phase already. And that includes new donor history questions, new algorithms that will determine who is and who is not deferred based upon the responses, et cetera. In a perfect world, we sometimes see in Star Trek, and I love Star Trek, that everything's wrapped up neatly in a one-hour episode. You tell the computer what to do, it does it, a cure comes through, bam. Unfortunately, it's not quite that fast in real life, and we're looking at a few months during which we make sure these systems work the way they should, because the worst thing we could do is roll this out in such a way that we accidentally, through not enough pretesting, allow inappropriate blood to get into the transfusion supply. So, long and short, thanks for bearing with us for just a few months as we finish putting everything into place and make things more inclusive, as well as up our donor game.
Chris, thanks for the time.
Vicki, thanks so much. Wish you an excellent remainder of your day. And I'll be listening to your next segment, too.
Dr. Chris Gressens is Vitalin's Medical and Laboratory Director, discussing the FDA's policy change to allow more gay and bisexual men to donate blood. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.